First came the night, then came the dawn. Now comes the most eagerly awaited day in horror film history. George A. Romero's Day of the Dead.
You're wasting time trying to define what's happening.
But the odds are against them.
We're in the minority now. Something like 400,000 to one by my calculations.
Their time is running out.
They can be fooled, don't you see? They can be tricked into being good little girls and boys. Same way we were tricked into it. I promised some reward to come.
But when the tricks wouldn't work...
They're actually learning.
Their world fell apart.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. And this is another installment of our ongoing series, School Sucks at the Movies. Ooh, we have a theme song for that. Hold on.
School sucks at the movies.
So let's start here. The opening of the show today. Yes, that was, in my opinion, a clever edit of the trailer of George A. Romero's 1985 film Day of the Dead to serve a purpose, and that purpose is to address an important theme in today's show. You'll hear Corey say this later on, but zombies have always represented this sort of, you know, herd mentality, mindless collectivism. He gives a couple other examples of things that zombies could be employed in film to criticize in culture and society. In this movie we're going to talk about today, World War Z, zombies seem to represent something else. But we'll get into that in more detail in the show. And, you know, that being said, I used to laugh when I would watch videos of somebody like Alex Jones talking about the hidden agenda behind certain blockbuster Hollywood films. We'd talk about Batman. He would talk about Blood Diamond. I would laugh. I would say, that's silly. Then I saw World War Z. I am not laughing anymore. This movie was terrifying, how heavy-handed the propaganda in it was. And what's also terrifying to me at this point is how nobody else, besides Alex Jones, from what I've seen anyway, is really talking about this. So, in this case, kudos to Alex Jones. We're actually going to use some clips of him in the show. So there's also a 15-minute video version of this show on YouTube. Already receiving some interesting feedback in the comment section, the dreaded comment section of YouTube. One viewer, Morris, writes, "You guys are so much smarter than most everybody else. Are you aware of that? I don't know if you are because you seem so humble." Thank you, Morris. I appreciate the compliment or the very thinly veiled criticism. We're pretty bitter in this one. I have to admit, Osborne and I spent good money to see this film in 3D. We talk about that as well. And I guess that kind of came through in the show. I'm sorry, sometimes this live format makes it a little tricky to strike the right tone, as Morris noted in his comment. I agree. And, you know, that just makes me want to express some extra appreciation for all the people who do subscribe to our YouTube channel and check out these videos that pretty much are raw. They are all generated from the live show and the small group of people that actually sit there with us and watch the live show and see the raw version of what becomes the podcast, which is often very different. It's longer. It's more messy. So yeah, definitely thanks for, you know, sticking with us over the course of the last year as we incorporate more of these live shows. Something new, new challenge. It was really important for me to do this, and I'm trying to, you know, do a 1-to-1 ratio of live show to non-live podcast or interview at this point. In fact, the next show we are going to conclude our How the Truth Became Illegal series. Richard Grove will join me. And Kevin Cole, both from Tragedy and Hope. And today's show actually contains a little preview of where we're going in the next installment of that series. So we'll get right into the show. Oh, by the way, recently I received a donation of 5 bitcoins but I have no idea who sent it. So I want to say thank you to that anonymous person. That was very, very generous. And thank you to everybody for your support, not just in tolerating our learning how to do live radio, but all the different ways that you guys support the show. It is greatly appreciated. So we're going to start today about 3 minutes into the live show. Really sorry about this. You know, we hired this guy named Steve to press record when we go live. Well, it turns out his union is on strike, and I forget about this, and I don't remember to do it until 3 minutes into the show. Jeez, you know? Now, you don't really miss anything, aside from just introductions, and when we start here, Corey is going to be talking about the book. In fact, we do a pretty in-depth discussion about the book, which is how the Infowars.com analysis comes into it, before we even talk about the movie at all. So that is what is going on when we transition to the live show right now.
The book is written from the point of view of a journalist who is traveling the world after the fact, after the zombie outbreak has been dealt with and mostly contained and things are starting to get back to normal. He works for the United Nations, and his job is to make an account of how things developed in the early days and how things turned out at the end. So each chapter, the author is literally interviewing someone. It's written as a series of interviews. One of the guys he interviews is the Chinese doctor who discovered the first case of the zombie virus. He interviews a very high-ranking Mossad agent from Israel who talks about what his country was doing in the early days to try and contain everything. He talks to a member, I believe he's a member of the guards of Buckingham Palace, because the queen, when the zombie outbreak happened, resolved to stay in Buckingham Palace and not flee the country as a show of strength to her people, for example. He talks to an American soldier when the U.S. Army tried to make a stand against the zombies at Yonkers, New York, and got utterly massacred because they were trying to fight the zombies as if they were people.
Right.
And none of their shock and awe tactics works because zombies don't feel shock or awe.
Right.
And they just got totally stormed and eaten.
Well, I would say based on the selection of people so far, this is and the queen, you know, staying as like a symbol of power, it's sounding pretty statisty. But from what I've heard, it's like that's not really the case.
Yeah, not really. I mean, they talk about the U.S. Army and how badly it gets beaten at the Battle of Yonkers. Later on in the book, towards the end of the war, they talk about how the army got its shit together and how they figured out how to fight zombies effectively. But they also talk about refugees who fled to Canada, because a lot of people were told in the early days, head north, because when it gets cold out, the zombies freeze solid and fall over, so they can't eat you. The problem is everything else up there is frozen too, so there's no food. And people were starving to death. There's a chapter interviewing a relief worker who was flying supplies back and forth across zombie-infested infested territory where her plane goes down and she has to flee zombies with a sprained ankle. And she sleeps in a tree with an army of zombies trying to get at her at the bottom of the tree and all this. She finally escapes and somehow. There's all sorts of interesting stories happening. Stuff happening in various other countries. There's a story from the point of view of a security guard who there's like all these like super wealthy and famous people holed up in a mansion on the east end of Long Island.
Yeah.
And him just talking about his experience there, like all the there's a very veiled reference to Bill Maher and Ann Coulter. Finally giving up and hooking up at the end of it when the zombies start storming the gates, you know, and he talks about what happens when everything falls apart there and how all these people are so out of it,
right?
Like so out of touch with what's going on around them that they just sit there like texting each other on their cell phones until zombies kick in the front door.
Finer detail question before we explore maybe some of the themes of the book. How fast did the zombies turn? Is that ever explained in the story?
No, but it wasn't very fast. Like, it was long enough that they had one story about a refugee camp, which I believe was in Israel.
Yeah.
And they had dogs at the gates as they were filtering the refugees in, if you were infected with the zombie virus, the dogs would bark at you. So if the dogs barked at you, they would not let you into the refugee camp, and they would put you in a cage with other infected people.
Okay, so that's, we're going to come back to that, because that's another interesting departure from the book that appears in the movie. But the other thing, basically the whole narrative has to change, because we're talking about somebody who's kind of interviewing people and basically creating a report of what had happened. Well, in this story, we do see there's a couple other people who are involved, but it's basically told, it's seen through the eyes of Brad Pitt, who is the protagonist, who it never even really clarifies like what he did or why the UN wants him back. But the UN is very, very central in the movie. Now, you said this was a guy, the interviewer, who is basically what Max Brooks is doing.
Right.
Also affiliated with the UN.
Yes.
Okay.
So there's another point of similarity. There's that and there's the title.
Right. So the Zambies.
Well, yes.
So people have said that the message of the book was much more individualist and liberty-minded, because it did say there was a focus on survivalism, which is more of a sort of, you know, individual and idea. But what I also read was that it's critical of the ineptitude of government.
Yes.
But kind of couples that with the idea of American isolationism, right? Which is kind of a malphemistic way to say America needs to be more of a global team player.
I guess, but there's also a thing that's mentioned a few times in the book, is that the one country who had a feasible and successful response to the zombie outbreak was South Africa, who just completely closed their borders, put martial law into effect, and just killed every zombie and every infected person they could find.
And that's kind of, Israel kind of has that role in the movie. Mm-hmm. I think there are obviously limitations of the movie because of, you know, shooting, right?
Right.
Now, they do go a lot of different places, at least in the story anyway, and it looks like they did shoot on location in Israel, but obviously it couldn't be as world-spanning in the movie. So I did want to read a quote from Brooks on the isolationism piece and his treatment of it as a theme. "I love my country enough to admit that one of our national flaws is isolationism. I wanted to combat that in World War Z and maybe give my fellow Americans a window into the political and cultural workings of other nations. Yes, in World War Z, some nations come out as winners and some as losers, but isn't that the case in real life as well? I wanted to base my stories on the historical actions of the countries in question, and if it offends some individuals, then maybe they should re-examine their own nation's history."
Mm.
So I think that also that we should speak to, before we start getting deeper into this and before we shift to the movie, there is also that kind of philosophic corruption that, you know, isolationism, or that not wanting to just kind of like be absorbed into a world community is isolation,
right?
It's not being a team player or whatever. And I think it's important to point that out, because that's very, very heavy in the themes of the movie. So I thought it would be fun. I thought we could have some fun before we go to the movie if we listen to Alex Jones review the book a little bit. And we can pause as frequently as necessary, and you can kind of react to what he's saying. His take is interesting, and he might be seeing it and kind of like laser focusing in on things that kind of serve his purpose or the story that he wants to tell.
Hmm.
Here we go.
What is the message behind World War Z? We're going to leak those secrets right now. The core of the book is a UN plan developed to use survivors as bait to lure in the zombies so they can be exterminated.
Can you find any truth in that based on your experience?
No.
Maybe he's like focusing in on one person's point of view, like, you know, maybe
like a conspiracy theory along those lines.
Or is there any person in the story who used another person as bait?
No, not that I recall. Yeah.
I don't remember that from the movie either.
Now, I mean, once they started to get their shit together at the end, and they figured out like an organized military plan for fighting zombies, what they would do is they would get into a formation where they could attack zombies wherever, whatever side they were coming from, and they would start playing really loud heavy metal music.
Okay.
Because the zombies were attracted to noise, and, you know, they would play heavy metal music because it would attract zombies and get the soldiers all hyped up for shooting.
Okay. If anyone is like, Brett, why the hell are we listening to this? It does factor into our story when we start talking about the movie, I promise. So we continue.
The number one enemy in this disgusting pro-genocide, anti-human publication is that humans that have not submitted to communism and the United Nations are undesirables that are worse than the zombies. As the globalists prepare the worldwide collapse, they must condition the public that humanity is ugly and needs to be killed. Those of you lucky enough to be behind the compact cities shouldn't complain and should do any Marxist job you're told. After all, only that can defeat the zombie.
What we're looking at here, it looks like it's from some kind of graphic novel.
Yeah, I've never seen that. I don't know if there was a graphic novel adaptation of it.
But he's talking specifically about the book here. So is any of this lining up with...
It's starting to sound a little more like something that happened in the book. One of the things they figured out, like, several years into this zombie invasion, like, the United States basically just said, everything east of the Rockies, forget it. If you're still alive, get to the West Coast. That's where we're setting up. And, you know, in a world where everything is broken down, there's no more technology, there's no more corporations, there's no more business, what he said about doing any Marxist job you're given...
Yeah.
Kind of sounds, you know, it was more like, and this chapter in the audiobook version was narrated by Alan Alda. He was like one of the top guys in charge of making sure everything ran smoothly. I mean, they were clearing out neighborhoods with teams of armed and trained volunteers.
Yeah.
Right. And the thing is, you know, they didn't need middle managers in this world. You know, they needed plumbers. They needed people who could make shoes. They needed people who could actually produce things. You know, they didn't need web developers. So a lot of people ended up having to get trained to do something new, something that would actually help.
Right.
So I can kind of see where he's getting that from, but that wasn't the central theme of the book. That was like a small part of one chapter of the book.
My speculation here, and I think this makes sense, is that where Alex Jones is coming from is that he's going to reveal that he saw a version of the script for World War Z. And he might have gone on a focused hunt into the book. Like, because if he read a script that was basically similar to what Jason and I saw on Sunday, yes, he is right to be concerned.
Okay.
So then if he learned that it was based on a book and hadn't seen the movie because he did this before the movie came out and maybe hadn't read the book, he would try to find things in the book.
Well, and as... I'm going out on a limb here. He would think, hey, this film script I have here is based on a book. Presumably it has something in common with the book.
Right, exactly. So let's continue. Let's do another minute and see what else we pick up.
World War Z is a regurgitation of the same message we've been hammered with our whole lives. The UN is the planet's savior. Humanity is the world's enemy. Only world government will save you from the disgusting zombie filth that is humanity. The globalists have publicly bragged that they engineered World War I and World War II to create the League of Nations and UN and to begin the destruction of the nation state. So if World War I and World War II were wars against the nation state and national sovereignty, World War Z is a psychological warfare simulation declaring war on humanity itself with humanity as the enemy and the UN as the savior.
Now, I think he's taking a little bit of artistic license there with his tie into the book, but the historical context that he's providing, I mean, if we take out his tone of voice, the music in the background.
What's wrong with his tone of voice?
and maybe some of the alarmistness of him, if I may make up a word, then he is describing a history that is generally true. Now, also, it's important to consider his point of view. Alex Jones is a real, you know, Constitution, Bill of Rights as kind of a god, plus God, which he sees, you know, as his protagonist in this fight against this antagonism, the godless communism collectivism, which there is truth in that as well. So the emotional pitch for him is maybe different. They're against the Constitution. They're against national sovereignty. They're against God. And that maybe, you know, turns his emotions up a little bit. But if you can read through his, you know, overzealous presentation, what he's saying historically does make sense to me. Open conspiracies, Fabianism, roundtable groups, the CFR, like stuff that is real. You know, there are questions about how cohesive is it all? How successful is it all? How much competition is there in those halls of power? But I don't have much of a problem with what Alex Jones is trying to convey here about the history that he's trying to match up to the book.
Now, the big stretch is where he's trying to tie it into the book World War Z.
Right. But if this is based on a film script that he saw, it's making more sense.
Let's talk about Brad Pitt, who was in a bidding war with Leonardo DiCaprio over the book World War Z. We've analyzed it, and I can say unequivocally, this is a manifesto of United Nations worldwide genocide against nation states and individuals. It is a declaration of war and a sacrament to planetary bloodlust and the New World Order's wish to reduce world population. In brief synopsis, the book begins with the disintegration of the world civilizations by an outbreak of zombies and the world transforming itself under UN leadership as a single international union to save humanity.
No. The first part, sure, where all the countries, like a civilization falls apart because zombies are eating everyone.
Right.
You bet. Accurate. Unless I'm really misremembering what happened in the book, a large part of what was going on in that book is that every country was pretty much doing their own thing. The only thing those countries had in common, the only time any of these countries really interacted with each other was when refugees fled from one to another.
Right.
And that's pretty much it.
So it's interesting because there is this scene in the movie that we're going to get into where Israel is very much doing what South Africa is described as doing in the book. And Brad Pitt comes in, this UN envoy, and plays a power card and is like, you know, gets into the city and almost takes on this leadership role. I'm remembering that correctly, right?
Yeah, he pretty much just manhandles everyone wherever he goes in the movie.
And
people just do whatever he says.
Under Marxism and the extermination of all American gun owners. From the book World War Z. That's when the UN multinational force was created, and we were pleasantly surprised by how many people signed up in the first week. The biggest enemy for this communist UN takeover are domestic secessionists of the United States. The Rebs only welcomed you with gunshots. The brass had special units for Rebs. I saw them on the road once crossing the Black Hills. That was the first time since the Rockies that I ever saw tanks. Bad feeling. You knew how it was going to end.
This is the interview where, you know, after they pulled west of the Rockies, kind of got everything together, retrained the army, developed new tools, whole new types of rifles, because automatic weapons are fairly useless. You needed precision, you know, rifles to get those quality headshots. New hand-to-hand weapons. They had these combination zombie fighting blades / trench digging shovel. They called a lobotomizer because it was specially designed for taking out the brain of a zombie. Mm-hmm. And they started making their way east, clearing out the zombie population, recovering pockets of surviving humans. And this sounds like it could be from that part of the book where there are pockets of resistance, who people who have been toughing it out, fighting zombies. And I guess when the army comes back through to reclaim the country, they decide they don't want to be part of the United States anymore, that they're doing fine on their own.
The ultimate crime is owning a gun, not under UN control.
I don't
Those
remember
that submit
them.
And turn in their firearms are called Robinson Crusoes and are given a nice job at the forced labor camp. The body armor was for protection against some of the regular people we found. I'm not talking organized rebels, just the odd LMOE, or last man on earth. Some dude or chick didn't manage to survive. Most of the time we managed to talk them down. Those we called RCs or Robinson Crusoes. That was the polite term for the ones who were cool.
You know, now that I think about it, they did run into, like, you know, lone survivors out there who've been out there literally for years with no one but zombies for company. Mm-hmm. And yes, some of those people might have been a little crazy and would have shot at the soldiers whose intention was to rescue them.
Yeah.
You know?
And again, I think this is informed by his perception of what the movie is going to be all about. By the way, anytime you want, 843, join SSP, Skype in School Sucks Live, join this conversation. If you've seen this movie or read this book and you think that there are additional details that you could provide, any place where we need to be straightened out, that would be helpful. I did get some good feedback from people online This whole clip is 14 minutes. I'll link to it in the show notes.
Just looking at, having a quick look at the synopsis on Wikipedia, I remember something I forgot. They did have like a UN meeting off of the coast of Honolulu on a U.S. aircraft carrier. And the weird thing, he's talking about how this like push eastward to reclaim the U.S. from zombies was under U.N. rule. But what actually happened was most of the countries of the U.N. were like, nope, if we just, you know, we cordon off a safe area, we keep zombies out of it, and we just wait it out because they'll eventually fall to pieces or whatever. And they just want to wait it out. And the U.S. is the only country that's, nope, we're going to take our country back. We're going on the offensive. So that's a little kind of hole in his idea of, hey, let's, you know, raw UN, because the U.S. was the one country that went, nope, we're not going to go along with what the rest of the world is doing.
UN concludes that you are not a communist socialist. You are used as bait to lure in zombies because you are the number one enemy.
No, the only people who were out there, like, luring in zombies, like I said, they also, they cleared neighborhoods using trained civilian, armed and trained civilian squads. And the people who were actually clearing out the rest of the country were, you know, Army, I don't know if they had a draft, I don't recall, but, you know, mostly Army volunteers. And yes, they kind of used them as bait because that's the one thing that zombies are interested in, is eating people.
Yeah.
If you want to kill the zombies, if you start attracting zombies, they're going to bunch up and be easier to kill rather than just try to poke it through every nook and cranny of the country trying to hoping you'll find a zombie. Yeah, you want to draw them in.
Before you can be used as slave labor, you must submit to re-education camps. They actually call them re-education camps. From the book, this was the National Re-Education Act. I'd say it was the largest jobs training program since the Second World War and easily the most radical in art history. This is a way to roll out authoritarianism and make it sexy and fun and condition the public that this type of mass murder is okay. This film talks about, man, my dad was smart. He loved Marxism. And now that we've got Marxism under the UN, it's so great. Yeah, we put people in labor camps. Yeah, we put them in re-education camps. He used methods that were almost Marxist, the kind of collectivization that would make Ayn Rand leap from her grave and join the ranks of the living dead. I've always rejected the wisdom he tried to impart, running as far away as Wall Street to shut it out. Now I'm racking my brain to remember it.
And do you know the context for that?
Yeah. He was a former Wall Street executive, and now he's in charge of running this re-education program. And as I said earlier, it's not, you know, it wasn't just, hey, let's reshape the world for no reason. It's everything is destroyed. Our entire infrastructure, our economy, everything is gone. The majority of our population is either dead or undead. And we don't need mortgage brokers anymore. So if you're a mortgage broker, you couldn't just get a job because there weren't any jobs around. Nobody was really doing business. Taken out of context, yeah, it sounds very sinister what he's talking about. But in the context of the entire world is overrun with flesh-eating zombies, and your choice is either back up over here into the U.S.-controlled zone or go out into where zombies will eat you and there's no food or anything. You know, they don't need mortgage brokers in that situation. You need to be able to do something helpful and productive, which makes sense in that context. But out of context, the way he's talking about it, you know, it does sound very sinister. And I wouldn't be a big fan of it if it had to happen. But in that context, like, you could drop zombies into any context and all bets are off as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that's, I think, where he's kind of getting this sinister feeling of it. And didn't you feel in the movie, Osborne, that it was the situations were created and time was of the essence in such a way that it was like, oh, yeah, okay, I understand why this is happening. And I was kind of racking my brain while we were watching it, like, what would be the alternative here? But it also happens in this world, right, where all of these mechanisms for problem solving are already, you know, moving along at full speed.
Yeah.
So when a crisis happens, where are people going to look?
Right.
And crisis is a great time for the centralization of power. So it's an important insight that you make. But I think that that's what he's saying is like the really good propaganda makes people like us believe that this would be the only way forward.
Right. See,
without going back.
Take this for, you know, whatever this means to you, but he's completely skipping the first, say, three quarters of the book, where almost every government in the world makes a complete hash of this and everybody dies because the government tries to use the mechanisms they have in place to respond to these sort of things, and none of them work because they're not designed to deal with zombies, and everything just falls apart.
Did you feel that way in the movie, though? Did you have that same kind of experience as me where you're like, how else? What would be the alternatives here? Because I really struggle with that, and I'm like, yeah, I guess that's what you should do.
What are you going to have? Are you just going to have Indiana Jones, you know, running around with his bullwhip, you know, taking care of the zombie apocalypse?
Bullwhip is no use against zombies.
So, you know, that's the challenge here that I think we face, you know, trying to bring voluntarist ideas to the table in an analysis of this, is that it starts with this world, right?
Yeah.
And it only escalates what's already going on in this world.
Right.
So that's a real challenge, and it makes a very, very effective propaganda. And I can't speak to the book, but the movie, and it does sound like we are speaking to the book a little bit.
Sure.
But
very select portions of the book. For the most part, during a zombie invasion, mm-hmm. yes, sure, there is an individualist way of responding to a zombie invasion. And then there's another way, you know, where you don't get eaten by zombies.
Well,
I mean, they do show examples of various people trying to figure out a solution or a way to survive on their own, some successful, some disastrously unsuccessful.
I think that the idea of trying to survive on your own sounds equally unappealing.
There are examples in the book also of people who managed to do that.
Right.
Like there was an old Japanese man who, he's very, very old. Like, he's old enough to have been lost his eyesight because he watched Hiroshima explode.
Yeah.
Right. And he becomes part of this, like, untouchable group. There was, like, a group of untouchables in Japan who were, like, at the lowest levels of society who, like, their families don't even interact with them. And I don't remember all the exact details of why that is, but it had to do with him being blind and all this stuff. And he just, when all this went down, he just went to, like, a national park on or around Mount Fuji and just lived in the woods, ate whatever you could find to eat in the woods, like roots and stuff, enough to survive. And he was actually really good at killing zombies.
Well, I think this is somewhat of an archetypal character, too. And when we talk about individualism, I mean, the only place that individualism really exists is, like, in thought, in choice, in action. But it's not a way of living. And I think that this archetype that we're talking about that appears in a lot of dystopian and disaster and horror movies, right? This weird person who is by themselves in a terrible situation, and our reaction to it as the viewer or the reader is, geez, that guy's a creep. You know,
yeah.
I would never be in that situation by myself. So, yeah, we're not talking about, like, one on zombies kind of situation here.
Right.
But the polar opposite of that is the complete surrender of all autonomy to the most distant power that you can get without actually going to, like, a Star Wars galactic empire. The UN is the most distant governance for people on Earth. The closest is the individual, self-governance. The furthest is the UN or some other kind of centralized global control. You'd have to go into space to get government further away from yourself than the UN. So the idea that it's pushing for that, and maybe to some extent, especially in the movie, or these movies generally, kind of make us very skeptical about the possibility of being an autonomous individual. That's an interesting dynamic.
It's funny because, you know, as I think about it, like, most of the time when people try to do rational critiques of the underlying themes of zombie movies, especially like the George Romero zombie movies, especially Day of the Dead, they tend to focus more on zombies as being like avatars of mindless collectivism or mindless consumerism and mindless, like, groupthink, because all the zombies are identical to each other. They all want the same thing. They all go about it in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, like, really the opposite of that.
We'll give him about one more minute here and then we'll move on.
They didn't do what they were told. They were killed. God, there's such a beauty to that. Yeah, I guess if you're a dirtbag psychopath or somebody worth hundreds of millions of dollars like Brad Pitt, who's married to that angel of death, who's bragged she loves death and evil, Angelina...
We'll get to her.
Yeah. Wow,
Jolie,
he really doesn't like
who
her.
Travels the world to hype up NATO.
Oh, he has for years had the hardest of boners for her. Like, he called her the other video I have queued up, which was the first I ever heard of any questions about the Angelina Jolie character it happened when I was researching Kony 2012,
uh-huh.
and she had kind of a central role in encouraging U.S. involvement, military involvement in Africa. So that's kind of what he's speaking to here, even though he's being a little hyperbolic.
Invasions and Al-Qaeda invasions of free countries where they line up blacks by the tens of thousands like Libya and kill them, or where they attack Syria for 22 plus months and engage in all sorts of evil. And there she is saying, it's humanitarian, kill them, kill them, when she's not making an Illuminati Tomb Raider film. After all, they're all just Arab zombies, just like in this movie. Trying to get over the Israeli wall.
Oh, dear.
That was a very powerful scene. Oh, we're going to spoil the shit out of this. I hope no one minds, and I really recommend you don't see it.
I have no interest in. I had no interest in this movie. I have less now that you've described it to me.
It's infected with the virus. Black vans come around and snatch and grab you and throw you in them to take you away and kill you. So it is pure conditioning for snatch and grab. It is pure operant conditioning and preparation to get the public ready for unbelievable evil. And you're told you will serve the megastate. You will serve the greater collective of the Supreme UN Soviet, or you will die. Quoting the book World War Z. The Rebs, on the other hand, armed, organized political secessionists. They were easily our most tangible danger. He would say in private, these must be eliminated swiftly, decisively, and by any means necessary. These were the enemies of our country, the domestic ones. A floating UN command center off the coast of Hawaii, consisting of 72 delegates, controls the fate of the world. Nation states are the problem. The UN's got the answers.
So that lines up a little bit with what you were saying, though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That through most of the book, that was there was that kind of self-determination. Yeah, okay. So that lines up more with where the book ultimately goes. And that's, if what he's saying is right, that's the beauty of the propaganda. It's like all other options have been exhausted. In this situation, this is what has to be done.
Right.
But again, I just really want to stress, I know I'm repeating myself, that is all built on top of the paradigm in which we currently find ourselves.
Well, fair enough. I can see it. I mean, you know, it's an extreme exaggeration. Like, hey, you know, you can't handle these externalities without the help of the state.
Yeah.
You know, and in this case, the externality is zombies.
Right.
And okay, that's a very good point. I mean, you'd have to have a large scale organized response to something like that. You know, and there's just, it just feels like there's no piece of fiction that some libertarian somewhere can't make me feel guilty for enjoying.
That was kind of what...
Damn it, people.
That was something that also angered me the other night, is that zombies have such appeal to liberty-minded people, because it's like, oh yeah, that is what it's like, you know.
Yeah.
So to get back to that question of why are we using clips of Alex Jones? Well, as I was sitting there and we were watching it on Sunday, I said, like 25 minutes into it, I was like, Alex Jones is going to shit when he sees this, right? Mm. Like I said at the very beginning of the show today, it almost looks like a movie that was conceived to provoke conspiracy theorists. The kind of people who say that globalists or globalists is kind of like one of those words that it's easy to just kind of dismiss as noise, but internationalists is a more accurate word for a real agenda that's happening in the world. And it seems to hit on all of these things that a lot of conspiracy theorists are really concerned about. Guns. I always, when I see a Hollywood movie, I say, what is there going to be their attitude of the usefulness of guns?
Right.
So Brad Pitt is quickly armed in the film. Right, he has a rifle very early on, and we're gonna go through the plot. But I just want to hit these themes that I found to be somewhat interesting. There's a scene where he's going with a doctor to South Korea, right? And he gives him a firearm, like a handgun. And while he's walking off the airplane, he trips and falls and shoots himself and dies. That's I think a strong anti-God message that you can trip and kill yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've seen in movies or TV shows where someone drops a gun and it accidentally shoots somebody.
Right.
Sometimes twice. Like,
yeah.
That doesn't happen.
Right. So that's the first one. The second one is there's a very strong theme of world government running throughout this. The UN is very, very central. That's where he's taken when he's evacuated from the city. That's the people who want him. That's where he used to work. It's never clear what he did for the UN. The World Health Organization factors very heavily into this. Vaccines, injecting people with things that are potentially hazardous to their health, but for a greater good. Camps. That was one of the things where I get to a point and I'd be like, yeah, I see why people would need to be in camps, you know, which is not something that I usually think of myself saying. Like, I really, it's hard for me to, yeah, I could see a place where people need to be put into like some kind of FEMA camp. I can see that happening. But I mean, that's the thing too. Like, it's one big giant lifeboat situation.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, if you want to propagandize people towards, you know, an acceptance of these things, the lifeboat situations are what you have to create. And often when we're talking about our ideas with other people, what they try to find and grasp onto and drag into the argument is a far-fetched lifeboat situation that they feel like they can have some relief from having to acknowledge the validity of these ideas, like the non-aggression principle or even property rights, if they can come up with some kind of lifeboat scenario that just gives us pause just for a second. Yeah. You know, 3-second pause without having an answer, a thoughtful answer ready to go, and they win.
Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, zombies, lifeboat situations are very useful.
A worldwide zombie outbreak is really a hell of a lifeboat situation, because if you are not part of the solution, you are part of the problem.
Right, right.
Because if you get killed by zombies, or if you die for any reason, you become a zombie. So you either get, you know, come to the FEMA camp where we'll keep you safe, or become part of the problem.
Yeah.
And even the people who haven't become zombies yet are described as being part of the problem, because they're taking pot shots at the guys who are trying to clean up the zombie mess.
It's the ultimate lifeboat genre, I think. So that was guns, that was vaccines, that was world government, that was camps. The fifth one was Israel. This is an interesting one. And at this point, when the guy shoots himself by falling, that was when I first was like, okay, let's pay attention. This might not just be a fun zombie movie. Let's deal with the Israel one. At one point, after they leave South Korea, they talk to this former CIA guy who is he was involved in some kind of espionage, but they're holding him prisoner, right? And he says, you have to go to Israel. They knew about it before it happened. And my ears perked up a little bit from my old 9/11 conspiracy days.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was a central piece of the Zionist 9/11 thing. And now I'm not saying that, oh man, it all ties together. You know, what I'm saying is this seems like it was intended to be provocative to people who are in this mindset. So Israel has prior knowledge of the zombie outbreak. Now, you guys might know this. People in the audience, you might be unfamiliar with this. One of the central pieces in the Zionist were behind 9/11 conspiracy centers around this Israeli company called Zim that was actually a subsidiary of the Israeli government. They had offices on two floors of the World Trade Center in the North Tower, considerable amount of space. They vacate a week prior to 9/11, forfeiting about $50,000 because they had the lease until the end of the year.
Right.
Suddenly, without explanation. Half owned by the Israeli government. So this was, for many people, a central piece of evidence that the Israeli government, or, you know, like somebody works for Zim who knows somebody in the Mossad, something like that. But for many people, what it translates to is Israel had prior knowledge of 9/11. So I felt like if you know that, when you hear Israel has prior knowledge of the zombie outbreak, that immediately snapped to the front of my mind.
Yeah.
When I heard that. So it was almost like it was intended to be provocative. So guns, Israel, vaccines, people trying to get over a wall in Israel, that's part of it too. The world government role and the camps. So what did you think of the movie itself, Osborne?
In general, there's very little coherent plot involved. It didn't really have an ending. There were some scary moments.
There were some scary.
I did jump out of my seat a couple times.
Yeah, yeah. Like a zombie comes right up into the camera.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I feel like the 3D did nothing whatsoever.
Right, yeah. The 3D was not very good. It didn't really add very much to it, except you get to look at other people's greasy fingerprints in front of the movie.
Yes.
It was almost like the process of sitting there and watching all this happen for 2 hours was a delivery system for the themes that we've already described. That's how I felt. I felt like the movie had a blah kind of plot. It was like somebody kind of edited together a bunch of action sequences into a somewhat coherent story.
Point of interest, the movie was not filmed in 3D.
Ah.
It was fake 3D.
Yeah. Well, the 3D added nothing to it. It was totally unnecessary. In fact, if it was not in 3D, like it has a visual style of kind of like Children of Men. Like it's not bright and flashy. It's kind of gritty and kind of like blended, muted colors. Yeah. From a cinematography point of view, when you see it, you say, this is not like other zombie movies. Right. This looks like a war movie. That's how it feels. And it just kind of ends. And I felt like the savior, if there was a savior or something on the way to being a savior, it was the friggin' World Health Organization. And Brad Pitt preparing these injections that it's going to give everybody.
Yeah. Now, I will say the World Health Organization wasn't able to figure this thing out. It was this lone wolf Brad Pitt guy who strolls in there and has the answer in his own brain.
Right, right. Now, wait, how did he formulate that answer? Because he recognizes...
Real sketchy. Just like he saw three people that had the zombies run past them.
Oh, so he realizes it's because those people are sick and
there
the zombies
are. There was an old man, there was a young boy, and, I mean, how are we supposed to know they're sick? I mean, what does that even mean?
Right.
So he just kind of pulls that out of his ass.
What we get is that he's like a very, very smart guy, obviously, if the UN wants him to come back and help them deal with the crisis.
Yeah, that was the other thing about the movie, is everything was like filmed in such a way that it's just like hitting you over the head with a hammer. This smart man is watching something to figure it out. Check out what he's doing right now. Like at the beginning when he's doing the count for the zombie turning.
And that brings us back to one of the most important aspects of the film. Mm. Very good point. The zombies, Corey, in the movie turn in, it's either
12 seconds.
It's either 12 seconds, right? So think about the urgency that adds to everything.
Right.
Right. So there is no time. If we want to go back to the conspiracy angle or what the movie is trying to push or push you into accepting, right, with all the things that I listed, there is no friggin' time. Right?
Right, right.
They change in 12 seconds. So we have no idea why that is added. I guess it drives the story, which is very fast paced. I don't think that what transpires in the whole movie in like the real life of the movie is more than a week. Right. It's very compact time wise. But because they change so fast, like in one scene, he's on an airplane. One zombie was hiding in the plane or got stuck somewhere in the plane. Bites starts going out and biting people in a minute. Everybody in coach is a zombie.
Yeah. See, the story kind of falls apart there because in the book, they're very clear about like the reason that this was able to spread around the world is because it took long enough to actually turn into a zombie that an infected person could get on a plane, land in another country, and then become a zombie.
They even bring that up in the movie. It's that the airlines were an effective delivery method. And I think they speak to that briefly in the film too, where when it first started, it took longer to develop, and it was over time that it
became
started taking effect more
virulent. What do the zombies eat too? That's the other thing. If like you become, they ignore other zombies. They don't eat other zombies.
They never.
Well, they're not even eating the people, right?
They're just biting.
They're just turning them into zombies.
That's stupid.
They bite them and they move on. So that's very unclear. They have no interest in eating people. They just bite them and kind of. They tug at them for a while, maybe there's a little blood, and then they seem like that person turns into a zombie, and they go on. So, but isn't that usually what happens? A zombie doesn't eat a whole person. How would you make more zombies?
Well, if you get away before they finish eating you, then you become a zombie. Or if you accidentally swallow, get some zombie blood in a cut or something. You know, it all depends.
Right.
It wasn't until 28 days later that we had this kind of setup where you get infected, get a drop of their blood in your eye or something, and you immediately become one of them.
Right, right.
Yeah, that was a pretty new thing.
Anything worth mentioning in the chat?
Somebody asked if we saw the trailer for The Purge.
Oh, yeah.
The Purge is the one where one night out of every year, like, all laws are suspended, right? People just go on a crazy rampage.
If anyone has anything you want us to read on the show, put it in all caps. That would be helpful.
Talk about your lifeboat scenarios.
No kidding. So, all right. Well, there's this game that conspiracy theorists like to play called the Connections Game, right? And sometimes it's extremely useful, and sometimes it's a dead end. So the fact that two people went to the same college is not a meaningful connection. The fact that two people went to the same college, were in the same fraternity, and masturbated together in coffins is a meaningful connection, right? Especially if they both wind up being presidential candidates.
I have to tell you, it's not really.
You don't think it can be?
Like, I couldn't tell you.
If I thought about the meaningful connections that I have with my fraternity brothers from back in the day that I masturbated with, like, I really couldn't come up with one.
I would be hard-pressed to remember the names of any of my fellow frat pledges who were also forced to pick up a meatball with their butt cheeks and walk across the room, and if they drop it, you had to pick it up and eat it.
Okay, point taken.
I couldn't even remember those guys' names.
Point taken. What I'm speaking about is a group inside, like, two people who go to Yale. Yeah, whatever. You both went to Yale. That means nothing to me. But Skull and Bones, which is not just any fraternity, is a very real thing. That if two people are bonded inside of that and they're there together, and we know what usually happens with the output of Skull and Bones members, that means more to me than just the fact that they were both at Yale, right? So that's solidifying a connection.
Sure.
Now, you could start playing this game, right? And I think this is one of the perils of conspiracy investigation, because I think some people wind up investigating or investing time in an investigation, and they pass a point of no return as far as time and emotion invested in this project. So as they try to connect things, they get to a point where they reach a dead end, and then they just have to find some kind of connection that can keep them going, because you can't turn back now. So Brad Pitt is the star of this movie. Brad Pitt's production company purchased the rights for this movie. It's called Plan B. B for Brad, probably. He's married to Angelina Jolie.
Right.
Angelina Jolie
was married to Billy Bob Thornton.
Whoa.
Who was in Bad Santa.
With Kevin Bacon. Nope.
No.
Yeah, but that's how that usually ends. Okay. Yeah. So... Now, Angelina Jolie is very interesting, and I do have this other Alex Jones clip that I first encountered when I was researching Coney, and what looked like a propaganda film that was to encourage mostly liberal people who under George Bush had been anti-war in this idea that there is such a thing as a humanitarian military effort, i.e. go into Uganda and capture Joseph Kony.
Right.
So that was where Angelina Jolie came on my radar, so to speak, as somebody there might be more to know about. Well, Angelina Jolie, not that people can't change and not that we should judge anybody by what they were doing 10 years ago, but I think it's worth pointing out that she was a relatively troubled individual for a good span of her life.
People are very excited about pointing these things out in the chat. Angelina Jolie and Billy Bob Thornton wore vials of each other's blood around their necks, and they had knife sex.
What's knife sex?
That was immediately the question that was posted in the chat.
What is knife sex?
By the same poster. I don't know.
So he says they had knife sex, and then he said what's knife sex? Yeah. Every time that phrase has ever come out of my mouth, the next phrase is, what's knife sex? I say, knife sex.
Yeah,
what's knife sex?
You really can't say knife sex without somebody going, what's knife sex?
It's almost like maybe you're trying to get attention by saying it.
Knife sex.
Oh, that sounds...
No, that's Nick. That was Nick.
Or knight sex, like they put on suits of armor.
Sex that involves using knives for cutting each other as foreplay.
I'm not saying Nick was trying to get attention. What I'm saying is that if you walked around saying that, like, knife sex, knife sex, you're really kind of offering. Yeah, it's kind of like, oh, gosh, is this going to be the conversation starter that I need it to be? So,
that sounds like a pork fest conversation.
She contemplated, I guess, at one point. She was institutionalized for a while, which, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm just trying to point out that this is not a problem-free past, right? She contemplated hiring a hitman to kill her at one point, I think shortly before marrying Billy Bob Thornton. But
he supposedly had an incestuous relationship with her brother.
Yeah, there's video. I think
there were some creepy overtones to their physicality with each other.
Yeah, but she makes out with her brother. So these are, I don't know. I don't know if these are things that are worth entering into this story. But around the year 2000, she begins to discover some of the horrors that are going on in the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to skim across the surface of this story. But she reaches out to somebody who is involved, I believe, with the UN and asks for information about refugee camps and takes an active role in like kind of, philanthropy and humanitarianism at that point.
Sure.
She is originally this adjunct figure, like a goodwill ambassador.
Sure.
Which there are a lot of, and a lot of celebrities do that. A couple of years ago, she was promoted to a special envoy to the person in charge of this refugee children division of the UN.
So, she's trying to collect the whole set.
So she's rubbing shoulders with different people now, mm-hmm. and having different ideas put in her head. Now, Osborne and I were talking before the show that supposedly her and Brad were both sympathetic to or understanding or accepting of the ideas of objectivism.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that doesn't necessarily...
Actually, I remember reading an interview where Brad Pitt said when the Atlas Shrugged movie was just an idea that somebody had and not a movie that was actually being made. Brad Pitt had originally, he had one point owned the rights to make Atlas Shrugged as a movie. He said, like, I've always wanted to be in Atlas Shrugged, the movie, ever since I pretended to read it to impress a girl in college.
Is that what he said?
That's what he said in the interview.
That's funny. Somewhere during this time where she's a goodwill ambassador, she is invited to join the Council on Foreign Relations. And the way that works, I think, is you need, somebody needs to recommend you, and then two people need to vouch for you, or it's something similar to that. Now, the Council on Foreign Relations is central to a lot of conspiracy theories. It's fair to say, I think, that they're also central in a lot of actual conspiracies, mm-hmm. like this open conspiracy of internationalism that we talk about all the time. This has been something that people have really thought favorably of since the late 1800s, and it really was a project that escalated and accelerated after the First World War with Colonel Edward House and the League of Nations, and was pushed along again by the UN. So there is very much today the existence of a global government apparatus that didn't exist in the world about 100 years ago. And whether Angelina Jolie was once into the ideas of objectivism or not, she kind of runs with a different crowd these days and seems to be a fairly capricious and impressionable person, as most celebrities are. And there is a long track record, even though I can't, with any certainty speak about her. Generally speaking, there is quite a track record of celebrities being easily influenced by government. I was just talking about the Red Scare. Yeah. And in both phases of the Red Scare, Hollywood immediately and really, from my research, uncritically rallied to the government's cause to produce, pro-U.S. government, pro-Red Scare police tactics, anti-communist movies. Now, you're not a shill if you're producing anti-communist media. We're doing that right now. But it just kind of, going along with what the government wants you to do. I think there's a lot of that in Hollywood. Today, in an unrelated example, we see Hollywood happy to do PR for the military if the military will make available some of their toys for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So an advisor from the Pentagon is assigned to Hollywood projects like the Transformers if they want to use military hardware in the movie.
Well, sure.
So,
and believe me, they do.
Yeah, they
do. Oh, Michael Bay loves his military hardware.
Right, right. So the Angelina Jolie trail kind of ends there. We will do a little bit more evaluation of Alex Jones in his evaluation of her. I really wanted to include this video or about half of this video in the show because it's called Alex Jones Calls for the Arrest of Druid Witch Angelina Jolie for War Crimes.
Nice.
And not to lessen the seriousness, if what Alex Jones is saying turns out to be true, I don't want to make light of this, but it's a funny title. So he's already laid some groundwork, but this is what I thought was worth sharing. So this is, and what I'm trying to introduce here is this is the more conspiratorial perspective.
I've watched her now push and say it's liberal and trendy to attack Libya and wreck that country and racial genocide against the black Libyans and put al-Qaeda in charge. No fan of Gaddafi, but he made deals with the West. Look what happened to him. They're attacking Assad of Syria, bringing in al-Qaeda. They overthrew the old dictator the U.S. backed and put in Muslim Brotherhood. Women are wearing burqas. No free speech now in Egypt.
Now, to be fair to Alex Jones, this was 13 months ago, and he pretty much nails Syria. So,
they're using al-Qaeda against Iran. They're using al-Qaeda against the U.S. to take our liberties. They're using them against Uganda. The Ugandan dictator has killed millions on record. And she's out saying, attack, go into Uganda. Because Joseph Kony, who hadn't been seen in 5 years, has a couple hundred fighters. I mean, it's just total war propaganda. With he's the new Hitler, invade Africa, when AFRICOM, our once military, is now announcing, just like NORTHCOM over the U.S., a jurisdiction over Africa with the U.S. invading with NATO all over Africa. I mean, I've got the New York Times last year saying, well, yeah, UN-funded groups are slaughtering farmers to take over the land for UN carbon sinks. I mean, why aren't you on that, Angelina Jolie? Joseph Goebbels, if he'd have been caught, would have been tried for war propaganda and crimes against humanity at Nuremberg. The problem is the UN is involved in global extermination everywhere. The UN is involved in genocide and child trafficking. Go look it up. I mean, it's so criminal, it'll make your head spin. They've twisted our military to do a lot of bad things around the world, but I'll tell you, nothing compared to the UN. They've got a criminal force. The globalists have tried to get our military to do a lot of really evil stuff, but on the ground, they don't usually do it. There's some anomalies and problems with the UN. You talk about an arm, just type in UN troops, sex crimes, sex trafficking, everywhere they go. I mean, it is a legion of evil.
Part of the concern, too, with the UN is that I think people don't factor obedience into the equation properly when they speculate this. But they say, well, their American troops would get to a point where with no posse comitatus, if they were turned on American citizens, they would say, no, I'm not doing that to an American citizen, which takes obedience, I think, out of the equation, because I think they would. I think a lot of them. And Kokesh had a video where he interviewed a soldier who was guarding the inauguration. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'd shoot American. I'd do whatever I was told. I mean, he's very blatant about it, the guy he's interviewing. One of the things that Alex Jones has always talked about is foreign troops, to be aware of foreign troops, which UN troops would be, because they see no, you know, cultural, personal commonalities with the people that they're turning their guns on.
Right.
So that's part of the a legitimate fear of a UN peacekeeping force that he's talking about.
But it's all about the ICC and hundreds of people they've got arrest warrants out for, and then the UN usually grabs you, takes you to The Hague, then you die in your cell. I mean, it is a joke. You can't call witnesses, nothing. What is the UN? It's just a big criminal consortium funded by these big megabanks. And Angelina Jolie is saying, arrest this person, invade Uganda, do all of this. The invasion's already on. It's like babies in incubators and stuff. It's just made up propaganda. Joseph Kony hadn't been seen in 5 years. It's just he's some guy in the bushes so they can say, there's the imaginary bad man like bin Laden. So I'm going to tell you, under your yardstick, Angelina, you've pushed for all these wars. You're a UN envoy. You are more guilty than Joseph Kony of war crimes against humanity. I don't think you're a useful idiot. You're a dangerous witch. And I'm sick of so-called liberals and they're warmongering all over the planet. You people are sick.
I agree. I agree with what he's saying. I think this idea of the humanitarian war is a very left-wing thing. If we look back throughout the 20th century, every war, even if we just focus on the United States foreign policy, every war was framed as a humanitarian effort by a liberal democratic president. Wilson, Roosevelt, Johnson. I mean, you could even take it to what Clinton did in Bosnia and Herzegovina, so Somalia. Yeah. And the idea that global government is appealing to what he refers to as mega banks, which is kind of just a generality that just sounds really conspiratorial.
Right.
That's absolutely true. That even though I don't think he's explaining it in a way that his audience likes and that he's comfortable saying. But the idea that money would be attracted to this kind of power, and I mean like real money, like Rothschild, Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, who were the people involved in this effort 100 years ago, there is an appeal because, you know, socialism isn't a movement, or collectivism generally. It's not a movement of the masses, you know?
Right.
I mean, they're the ones who give it momentum, but this is a centralization of social and political control that megalomaniacal types find very appealing, right? Because what you want to do ultimately, even if you need a few wars along the way, is reduce conflict and create stability in the world to protect interests. I think all this is very real. I think that it's a shame sometimes that this is the you know, what we're watching here is the delivery system for these ideas. And there's a lot of hyperbole for sure. But I think that there's an important general idea here that let's take all the specifics out of it, the UN and all the, you know, the globalists and all that stuff, the appeal of the centralization of power, right? Which really, really came through very strongly, you know, that message being pushed in this movie.
Right.
So there was no tie, and there was nothing I could find, and I read that shows, I figured she had like an executive producer credit or something. But the idea that she influenced this movie in any way, if it's out there, I can't find it. And if anybody knows of it, I would love to hear it. But
somebody points out in the chat, it's amazing that people would listen to someone like Angelina Jolie, who pretends for a living. You know, their whole life is based on pretending to be other people, and that's how they make their fortune. I think it's funny, too, that, you know, a few years back, if Angelina Jolie said anything in public, people would just be like, ah, pff, you're a kook.
Mm-hmm.
You have knife sex. Whatever. You know, and
what's
now
knife
people
sex?
Take, yeah, who knows? Now people take her seriously for some reason.
Right.
I guess because she's married to Brad Pitt and he's good looking, whereas Billy Bob Thornton was kind of weird looking.
Well, Angelina Jolie is, I mean, people take good looking people seriously. If they can, like, you know, get out of a car without showing their vagina.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Angelina Jolie was married to Billy Bob Thornton, I think that really did not work in her favor. Because he looks like he was carved from a potato. So she must be a kook and no one took her seriously.
Sure.
She was a joke.
What were you going to say, Osborne?
People make fun of the idea of listening to celebrities, you know, talk about important things.
But everybody
but I
does.
Think that's exactly the function that they should be used for. It's as spokespeople. You know,
right.
Like a spokesmodel, you know, spokesmen, a figurehead. You know, I mean, I've got no problem with, you know, famous, good-looking people, like, representing me, you know, politically, if that's a word.
But I mean,
you know, I do that with my company. I mean, like, I don't go out and talk to the public about my company. I have someone else who fulfills that role, who's better looking and people like.
Native Interface says, I only listen to people who can't get out of their car without showing their vagina.
No, but what I'm just thinking of, like, an example of somebody who was considered good looking and like just couldn't get it together. But celebrity is something that's taken very seriously, and it's very easy to talk to low information people through celebrities.
How else do you disseminate information to people who aren't willing to watch the news because it's too complicated and boring?
Well, that's where the danger comes in, too, because Osborne is not some sketchy figure lurking in the shadows who's sending out, like, pretty celebrities to do PR for a dirty operation. But, well, he shrugs. But
not that you know of.
This is far more nefarious. Right, where these people can be the face on something that they don't understand. So this isn't just celebrities, like politicians are celebrities, right?
Right.
George Bush was the figurehead, the lightning rod of an agenda that I don't even think he really understood. Woodrow Wilson was the same. Woodrow Wilson was, you know, I talked about it in a recent show, like how just beside himself and betrayed he felt by what his top representative, Colonel Edward Mendel House, the backroom deals that he was making in France, while Wilson had trusted him to come up with like a post-war solution. It's always these operators, these wire pullers, who have pushed out these kind of puppets in front of people while they stay in the shadows. And it said that, like, in an article I read by Robert Higgs, it said House didn't want to be the Secretary of State. House didn't want to be the Vice President. It's too much exposure. How much, wire pulling of these interested parties and special interests and academics like Project for a New American Century were happening in the background of that administration. And like the liberal media totally, for the most part, missed it. They're like, oh, all this is happening because George Bush is dumb. So celebrities serve the same purpose as politicians like George Bush and Barack Obama. They're the face on something that probably is not the best, you know, for everybody kind of plan.
Yeah.
But they don't understand what they're doing. And they might have to be sold on, you know, it's really for the common good, that kind of thing. So let's finish up with Alex here.
Yeah, there it is. Peacekeeper sex scandal lingers. What is that, New York Times? I mean, there's so many of these that come out every day. Folks, the globalists feed on the third world. They make movies like Blood Diamond. De Beers has a world diamond monopoly and runs all sorts of horrible stuff and sends mercenaries in to any country that mines their own diamonds. And then they make movies for the liberals and get every Hollywood star going, I want to invade countries that mine their own diamonds. The children are slaves. Total bull. It's all propaganda. The colonization of Africa has just continued, and they're exploiting it. So I don't want to hear all you bleeding hearts talk about how much you love Africa all day and how sad you are for Africa and how great Africa is.
Yeah.
So tired of it. I don't want to attack Angelina Jolie. I know for a fact that Brad Pitt's seen my films and reportedly, I'm not even going to get into it, likes them and all this stuff. Well, then what are you doing? I happen to know you guys met with Aaron Russo like 5-6 years ago before he died and watched his film and said you knew about the New World Order. What'd you do, run off and join it after you found out about it? I could care less about your stupid celebrity. I've met enough big celebrities as big as those two idiots that I could care less. I know that it means nothing, but to the public it means something, and your name is being used to sell all this evil.
Jeez, I guess we could have let him say it in like 12 words, but yeah, that's what we were hinting at. So that's the Angelina Jolie piece, and if anyone has anything to add to that, I felt like it's not a trail running cold, but it didn't lead to any exciting discoveries for me. The only other one, and this is really fishing, the executive producer of the film is named David Ellison. Father's Larry Ellison, who is the CEO or was the CEO of Oracle.
My dad was the CEO of Oracle. I could have a production company too.
Exactly. So the two things that I knew him for, and he's like, you know, if you put in like Larry Ellison globalism, you would find a lot of things, I'm sure. He basically bought his way out of an insider trading rap with Oracle by, you know, like flushing a bunch of their stock out, and was able to settle that and walk away without any kind of admission of guilt by donating, I think, $100 million to his own charity.
Nice.
Kind of a sweet deal. The other thing, after 9/11, he offered to basically donate a software package that would allow the government to build basically a national ID database, right? With ID card. And he talks about this and he says, you know, there is no privacy. I read this interview. There's like, there is no privacy. So all that you have to get over, you don't have to give up your privacy. Just give up your illusions of it and we'll be fine. You know, we see everything already. But even just to go back to his son, who is the person directly involved in the film, I looked at a 5-page Vanity Fair article about the trials and tribulations of making this movie. His name isn't mentioned. So he's a financier.
Yeah.
So it's naive to say that somebody financing a movie doesn't have input on the script. And what I'm doing is I'm just kind of opening holes for people to go into if they want. But I'm just saying the connection game had a couple of compelling entry points. But as far as I was concerned, at least with the time constraints that I had, they didn't lead anywhere that I found to be terribly compelling. So, yes, it's interesting that the executive producer of the film is the son of the Oracle CEO, who is, a globalist, internationalist, totally like anti-privacy guy. You know, not that he's framing it as anti-privacy, pro-security, we should say.
Yeah.
Pro, digitized fingerprints on a national ID card with a picture. That was the depth of my investigation to the connections of the film. But I think what's also important to remember here is the philosophic corruption, that people can participate in some kind of agenda without even realizing that they're a part of it. Or if they realize they're a part of it, they don't even realize the darker side of it. So it could be nothing more than that, because this is the zeitgeist, right? Mm-hmm. And when we talked about where do we go from here in this terrible zombie movie where there's all of this urgency and people don't have time to think and people don't have time to re-strategize, people don't have time to take a step back. Well, the only way is forward, and the only place to start from is where we are now. That is World War Z, the movie and the book.
Mm.
Thank you all so much for coming.
Now, somebody did ask earlier, and I didn't get to addressing it. Did anybody see Contagion? And what
yeah,
are
we've
your
been talking
thoughts?
About that off the air. Contagion is very similar to this movie, also starring Brad Pitt, I might add. Or was it Matt Damon?
Matt Damon.
Sorry.
Yeah.
And
they all the same to me.
What stuck out for you? Or you've seen it too, right?
Yeah.
So when along the same lines that we've been discussing tonight of this kind of propaganda in a Hollywood film, thoughts on Contagion?
That was very much the same story of the World Health Organization has to save humanity. They put people in camps. You aren't allowed to buy and sell unless you get what do they do, like a Mark of the Beast thing tattoo, or is it?
I don't remember that at all. I'll have to watch this.
Or is it like a tag
again.
They give you?
It's a really good point about Contagion. There was a guy, a blogger, a citizen journalist blogger, who was depicted as like the bad guy for spreading information about the disease.
Yeah, and he's kind of portrayed as the conspiracy theorist guy.
Yeah, but if I remember correctly, and I may very well not, that like the information he was spreading was actually true. or not.
No, I think he was spreading like misinformation about what the cure was.
To sell a cure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean the question that comes in from James is if the solution to these sort of problems, these propaganda-type problems, lies in the market, isn't there some kind of obligation to not finance this kind of propaganda, i.e. why are we giving money to these people?
Well, I think that's why we're warning people not to go watch it.
Yeah.
Because we were very unsuspecting when we went to watch this movie.
So, yeah, I think that's a great question, James, and really it's more of a point that he's making that I agree with. You know, I don't want to create like a Hollywood blacklist. Exactly.
Well, but, I mean, it really wouldn't. It would look kind of like Freedom of Information Act releases of like MK Ultra documents, where the Hollywood blacklist would be all black, with like occasionally you would see the word "the" not blacked out.
And it also kind of points out the uphill battle we have in that arena. Or when I say we, there's really no foot in the door for libertarian ideas in Hollywood, right? I mean, we can name the examples probably on one hand of movies that have really strong libertarian themes that come through the narrative and you walk away saying, yes, I could see that in the movie. I can't even think of any off the top of my head. And when I do think of these types of movies, they're also very heavy on violence, the protagonist using violence. So like V is an example, right?
Yeah.
But he is such a Machiavellian kind of character that it's almost unappealing. And it makes me, I hate it when people wear V masks.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And you know, basing it on this.
I mean, the Guy Fawkes mask that, you know, has become so popular since V. Like, you know, people just don't know. People don't seem to know, despite the fact that it was covered in the movie, who Guy Fawkes was or what he was about.
Yeah, he's a religious nut.
He wanted to replace the Protestant government with a Catholic government.
Right.
That's not a libertarian ideal.
No. So there's a real absence of these ideas, and I think that, you know, I mean, how many people will ever wind up hearing this during the existence of the movie? Maybe maybe 10,000 people.
Here's one of our examples from one hand about, you know, a movie with libertarian ideals, although this is hotly debated among Hunger Games.
Oh.
Hotly debated amongst the libertarians I know as to whether it has genuine libertarian values.
Well, the question is how watered down. I mean, obviously the story changes as it goes on, right?
Yes.
So how watered down will that be in Hollywood?
Yeah, that's the real question.
And we were even speculating about this with Atlas Shrugged, right? Like, Atlas Shrugged is such a blech of a movie, you know, that...
I thought it was a pretty blech of a book myself, but...
Right, well, I mean, yeah, it's certainly a difficult read, and it's a carrier for a philosophy.
Right,
so
right.
It might be difficult to translate, I mean, just the depth of philosophy in that book to even a trilogy of movies. So that looks like it's on its way to being a failure as far as the delivery system that the book was. But, you know, I think it is a valuable service that even if only 10,000 people ever hear this show, that there are people out there seeing this stuff, talking about this stuff. You know, we crapped on Alex Jones a little bit. And like I said, I think he's being a little bit hyperbolic. But, you know, I would have laughed if 5 years ago somebody said that they're injecting all of these propagandistic. I mean, I've always understood propaganda. I've always understood how ubiquitous it is in all forms of media.
Right.
But when he talked about, you know, the Batman movie, the way he talked about the Batman movie, I laughed, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I understood what he was saying. But I've always just chalked that up more as this is not the cause, this is the effect, right? Movies are made and these stories are told as an effect of the philosophical environment in which we live. They're not creating it. But I think it might go both ways. Closing thoughts. Anything else from the chat?
Things are starting to spin off. There's talk about The Matrix. There's talk about people bringing up Star Wars now. We could be here all night.
Well, I want to thank everybody for your participation in the chat. And please feel free in the future to call the show. So, that being said, that's the show. Thanks, everyone. I'll leave the stream running if people want to keep chatting.
Good night.
Later.
All right. Bye. That's the end of the show. So let's stop the recording and save. We'll call this show. And I'm going to add the word Zambies. Isn't there a country like Zambia? Yeah. Do you think that's related?
No.
I think it is.
Okay. It's related to the way you say it.
Zambies.